Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, the pandemic has kept many college students out of the classroom, and it's had an impact on enrollment. We'll hear from some about their decision. Illinois prisons experienced COVID outbreaks last year. The state stopped in-person visits, and they haven't allowed them since. That's had another effect.
He would have to be losing some of his humanity because you've got no visits, no human contact, no sense that anyone loves you.
A civil rights icon with ties to Central Illinois passed away last year, but a new book chronicles the life of C.T. Vivian. We'll talk with a co-author. We'll also hear about a new book on the Irish in Illinois. And it's been more than half a century since the state ratified its current constitution. We'll hear from a reporter who covered the convention. That and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a new book is out on a civil rights icon with ties to Central Illinois. We'll hear from one of the co-authors. Later, the pandemic's effect on college enrollment. And Illinois has yet to allow in-person visits with prison inmates since they were stopped last year due to COVID concerns. Those stories and more coming up this hour. Anti-Asian violence has been building over the past year. A recent analysis by the group Stop AAPI Hate found nearly 3,800 self-reported cases of anti-Asian bias in the U.S. throughout the pandemic. Recent shootings in Atlanta, which killed 8 people, including 6 Asian women, has brought that issue back into the spotlight. Christine Herman spoke with 2 people about how the Asian American community in Central Illinois has been affected by all of this. David Chi is director of the Asian American Cultural Center at the University of Illinois, and Teresa Mock is a licensed clinical psychologist in Urbana.
I want to ask what your reaction was personally when you first heard about the shootings in Atlanta that killed 8 people, including 6 Asian women. What was your first thought when you heard that news? Teresa, can we start with you?
Sure. I think I was horrified, but maybe sadly not surprised. I feel like the rhetoric has been building, that it's shown that there's that people at times won't speak up about how Asians are often perceived as other, as not belonging to this country, and that it came from the highest levels of government. So there's a way that those words get normalized. And then what we know is that when people are seen as other, seen as not American, it can end up wrongly, I think, but sort of justifying horrible, inhumane treatment. And so, yes, I wish I could say I was more surprised, but it was heartbreaking.
David?
I was also not surprised by it. I've been studying anti-Asian hate violence for 30 years, so I'm surprised by the amount of media attention it's been getting in the last month, and I'm pleased that more attention is being put on this important topic. But we know that there is anti-Asian bias and discrimination and hate rampant across the United States throughout history, but especially in this last several months in the past year, largely because of the racist rhetoric being used, calling COVID-19, the China virus or Kung flu.
I think it can be important to recognize that this is a phenomenon that's gone back hundreds of years, that people could look to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, Japanese American internment camps, that there's been a lot of racism and persecution of Asian Americans. And many of them have been in this country for generations. So I think that COVID's probably exacerbated things.
Can you also talk about what reaction you've been seeing in the Asian American community here in East Central Illinois? Maybe not just to this most recent incident, but to the overall rise in anti-Asian violence and anti-Asian hate that we've been seeing over the past year.
I've seen Asian Americans here locally angry and surprised and in despair, feeling frustrated about what's happening across the country. And we know that this is occurring even here in Illinois and locally in Champaign-Urbana. Maybe not as dramatically as what we've seen recently, but it still happens all the time. And we as Asian Americans never know when it might happen to us the next time that we go out to the grocery store or walk around on campus.
And I would say that too, that people who are directly affected. So I've talked to people who directly have had things said to them or been treated in a certain way, and that they struggle with then feeling stress, PTSD, despair, anger, but also there's secondary trauma that we know that happens for people who may read about events, hear about it, try to support other people in their lives when it's happened, that they may feel similar feelings.
Related to that point, Teresa, since both of you have worked in the mental health arena or currently do, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on the impacts of racism on a person's health and well-being, and whether we need to, as a society, think about racism more as a public health issue.
And I think it was only a couple of years ago that racism was declared a public health issue, which I think is really significant because there are a lot of health effects that result from incidents of discrimination, stress, racism, microaggressions. So people might feel heightened fear, stress, anxiety, but also a lot of uncertainty, grief, depression, or PTSD. And for some Asian Americans, depending on their own family history, that they may be experiencing even generational trauma if their families fled a country due to war, religious persecution, and that can all be magnified.
David, would you add anything to that?
I would just add a little bit. Racism obviously does affect individuals' health and well-being. At a broader level, it affects communities. We need more supportive systems of prevention and outreach to at-risk communities, including to new immigrants, low-income, and limited English language subpopulations.
You've both pointed out that this issue is getting attention now in ways that it hasn't before or hasn't as much. So I'm curious to know what you hope will be the change that happens going forward.
I think we need more people to stand up and be allies, be willing to intervene when they see something, even if it's not of their own group. We need stronger hate crime legislation and follow through in the court system. And it would help if we had teaching of Asian American history in public schools mandated throughout the country.
And Teresa, your thoughts?
Oftentimes, Asian Americans, I think, are left out of discussions of race in this country. In this country, when we talk about race, most often it's about Black, white issues. And I think that is very important and significant, and certainly more attention needs to be paid to it and that topic. And I think there is more attention being paid to it. But oftentimes then that leaves other communities of color, other marginalized groups invisible. And when you're invisible, I think there can be a real sense that things are not affecting certain groups. And I think there was even a lawmaker the other day who talked about he couldn't understand why there was any talk of this being a racist country or Asian Americans do well. And that interfaces with the model minority myth, suggesting that Asian Americans do well. They do fine. They do well economically, academically. And we know that that's not true. But if Asian Americans are either invisible or seen as doing well, then it can suggest they don't need any resources or they're not struggling in some ways. And I think with the deaths, particularly of the women, the Asian American women where that happened, that also interfaces with perceptions of them, that Asian American women don't make waves, they're not going to cause trouble, and that somehow it's okay to do this to them.
That's Teresa Mock, a licensed clinical psychologist in Urbana, and David Chi, director of the Asian American Cultural Center at the University of Illinois, and they spoke with Christine Herman. The Reverend C.T. Vivian died before finishing his memoir, It's in the Action. That left co-author Steve Pfeiffer with the job of telling the rest of the civil rights icon's story. Tim Shelley spoke with Pfeiffer about how he completed the book and some of Vivian's stories of living in Illinois.
He was 90 years old and he'd never told his story. So after a little back and forth, we decided to collaborate on a memoir that would be told in his voice. And we started, and we got quite far. I did quite a bit of interviewing with him, but as time went by, his memory faded, and he passed away as we were kind of towards the end of the process. But fortunately, there's so much that has been either recorded of him in the past or speeches or sermons that I was able to get my hands on previous interviews and so forth, so that I was able to complete the book even in his absence. Of course, I wish he were around, because there's been a lot of nice attention and recognition of his importance. And while he got plenty of that in his lifetime, it would have been nice for him to be getting it now as well.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about his childhood growing up in West Central Illinois, Macomb. That was kind of a pivotal formative period for him. I was wondering if you two had chatted a little bit about that.
While he did attend integrated elementary school and high school in Macomb, it was formative for him because he did experience racism. So when he was in high school, even though the teacher told him that he should have had the lead in the special junior class play, but that he couldn't because he was black and would he like to paint scenery, or when classmates told him that they'd love to have him over for parties or for dinner, but their parents wouldn't let him. It was really his first exposure to, I guess what you call institutional racism. And there's a great story he told me about when they first moved, where he was out in the yard and saw what he thought was a ghost, was a little afraid initially to approach it, but then gathered up all his courage and decided to go for it and approach the ghost. And it turned out to be sheets that were just hanging on the family wash on the clothesline. But he said it taught him a lesson that you don't back away from things that might scare you. And it actually served him very well.
To move down the road a little bit, he went to Western Illinois University, and then he came to Peoria, Illinois, to take a job at the Carver Center. And that was really the first time we hear about C.T. Vivian really engaging in nonviolent civil protests, so to speak.
The opportunity for kind of organized nonviolent direct action was a relatively new concept in the United States at that time. But what they were trying to do, I guess Bishop's Cafeteria wasn't allowing black patrons to sit at the tables. So they kind of came up with this ingenious way to shame the owners into seating blacks. The white people that were part of this protest, they would go in and two people would sit at a table for four, and then two black people would come in. And the two white people at the table would invite them to join them and really force the hand of the white manager to kick out the black people. And they would have to do it in front of all the other patrons. It took quite a few weeks, but they eventually wore down the management there and the cafeteria was fully integrated.
What was it like to hear his firsthand account of that pivotal moment in civil rights history with Jim Clark in Selma, Alabama, 1965, where he's struck by the sheriff and then he gets back up?
His memory of that was quite clear when I said, you know, how did you get yourself together to go back up there and speak so eloquently? And he said, I really didn't know what I was going to say, but you cannot walk away from violence when you're doing nonviolent direct action. You lose if that happens. And I knew that all those other people that I'd brought to the courthouse that day to register with me were counting on me to go forward. I would urge your listeners to go to YouTube and just put in C.T. Vivian, Sheriff Jim Clark. There are numerous videos of it, and it's really one of the most iconic moments of the movement. He's such an elegant and eloquent response to evil.
Tim Shelley talking with Steve Pfeiffer, co-author of the C.T. Vivian memoir, It's in the Action. The book is now in stores. Meanwhile, a new book aims to shine a greater light on the history of Irish immigrants to Illinois, and reporter Chase Cavanaugh spoke with one of its authors.
The work is a product of two people, Northern Illinois University history professor Sean Farrell and his former doctoral student Matthew Billings, who now works at the University of Indianapolis. Farrell says a key motivation behind the book, and its title, was to broaden the scope by which people see the Irish in Illinois.
The time seemed right to put it together in terms of the first statewide history of the Irish in Illinois. There's been a lot of great stuff on the Irish in Chicago and a lot of good things on the Irish in various communities, but There hadn't been anything that kind of brought that all together.
Farrell says the biggest contributor to Irish immigration in the public consciousness is the Great Famine, which took place in the mid-1840s.
And in terms of numbers, that's true. But if we look further back, Irish settlers and soldiers came to the Illinois country as early as the 1750s. You know, we're part of the French Imperial Army, the British Imperial Army. We're soldiers in the American Revolutionary War on the Patriot side as well.
The soldiers and settlers were also diverse when it came to religion. Farrell says in the 1780s and 90s, groups of Irish Protestants settled Illinois, coming up from areas such as Kentucky and Tennessee. Beyond that point, immigration picked up.
The real jumps in Irish settlement in Illinois come from the 1830s onward, and they're connected to laborers on the canal project. And then obviously with the famine emigration, more and more Irish people come to Illinois, to Chicago in particular, in search of work.
And while the Irish have many ties to large cities such as Chicago, from labor to politics, Farrell says that was far from the only destination.
You know, a fairly decent percentage of mid-19th century farmers are Irish immigrants. Matt highlights some in LaSalle County, for example, in his work. But the Irish experience in Illinois wasn't simply an urban one, an urban laboring one.
Such a book wouldn't be complete without profiles of several Irish Illinoisans. One is Jenny Hodgers, an immigrant to Belvedere. She disguised herself as a man, changed her name to Albert Cashier, and fought for the Union in the Civil War. Farrell says another figure is Sister Mary Williams Sullivan. She was an Irish-American Catholic sister who worked on civil rights in Chicago with contemporaries such as Martin Luther King Jr.
She described herself as a large, loud Irish nun sitting on the corner of Jackson and California, and, you know, a remarkable individual who worked for, you know, 70 years in service to people who needed it.
Farrell says the timing of the book's release right around St. Patrick's Day, quote, may not be an accident, end quote. He says there's already been positive reception from media outlets and academics on both sides of the pond. He also suggests it could be interesting to those with Irish ancestry.
A lot of people in Illinois, an estimated 1 million, still consider themselves Irish, and not just on St. Patrick's Day. So our book really is kind of aimed to kind of let them explore the range and diversity of the Irish experience here.
The Irish in Illinois is now out through Southern Illinois University Press. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
We have more of Statewide ahead. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The pandemic and college enrollment, it's had an impact on students. We'll hear more about it coming up. Well, the Illinois Department of Corrections halted in-person visits last March because of the pandemic. A year later, there's still no plan to allow families to reconnect, as Patrick Smith has more on that story.
Von Jones has been locked up in an Illinois prison for more than 2 decades with no chance of parole. Still, Kim Henry says he is the love of her life.
He is the father of my child, grandfather of my 3 grandchildren. He's a major part of the family, even though he's not there. He encourages us. He consoles us. He supports us. He loves us.
Before the pandemic, Henry would make the 45-minute drive from Carbondale to Menard Prison to see Jones every weekend.
Sit at the tables, you know, and talk. We can hold hands, which is something we do often.
But then on March 14th, 2020, the Illinois Department of Corrections halted in-person visitations to try and prevent the spread of COVID-19.
I lost a major support.
And for the inmates, COVID precautions have meant stricter rules around movement. There have been lockdowns and quarantines because of positive tests. Volunteer-led programming has been halted.
This year has been really rough on him. He would have to be losing some of his humanity because you've got no visits, no human contact, no sense that anyone loves you.
Jennifer Volenkatz heads the independent prison watchdog, the John Howard Association. She says there were understandable reasons why the state halted in-person visits in the first place.
Look, when it comes to issues of contagion, the reality is that, you know, prisons present enormously dangerous environments.
But she says the state has not done enough to support other ways for people inside to connect with the outside world.
the substitutes for in-person visits are just not nearly good enough. And they wouldn't be even if functioning properly, but they're not. So for instance, video visits have been plagued with tech issues. And access to phones has been really limited due to limitations on movement related to trying to contain COVID.
You know, Governor Pritzker set out guidelines for nail salons, hair salons, bars, restaurants. So why hasn't he set out guidelines for prisons? They're under his control. It really is upsetting to me.
Julie Anderson's son, Eric, is incarcerated. She says the state could set up outdoor visiting areas with rules around capacity and masking.
A lot of the prisons, when you're in the visiting room, you can look outside and there's an enclosed patio area that has a brick fence around it with tables there that they used to have outside visits, but they stopped them. That's attached to the visiting room. It's very easily for those facilities to have outside visiting. Very easy.
So why do you think IDOC hasn't done that?
Because they don't have to. They don't care.
Last week, Governor J.B. Pritzker unveiled a plan for the next steps in the state's reopening. It didn't mention the state's prisons. A spokesperson for Pritzker's Corrections Department says they're hopeful indoor and outdoor visits will be available by the summer, but she didn't answer what criteria need to be met for that to happen and wouldn't give a specific target date. For Kim Henry, she misses seeing the love of her life.
I need a hug. You know, after a year, I need some type of hug. I need to be able to hold his hand.
Henry says with the pandemic, it feels like prisons and the people inside of them are even more invisible than usual. I'm Patrick Smith.
Beginning this fall, all 12 of Illinois' public universities will begin using what's known as the Common App. It's a single online application used by hundreds of colleges and universities across the country. Three public universities in Illinois already use the app, in addition to 32 private institutions. Governor Pritzker's proposed budget for next year includes $1 million to help universities cover the cost of it. Lee Gaines with Illinois Newsroom recently spoke with Deputy Governor for Education Jesse Ruiz about the switch to the Common App and why the Pritzker administration is pushing the change now.
It's happening now because Governor Pritzker has championed this in his last two budgets, providing support for our public universities to do this. There is some expense, but we think it's well worth it, given the advantages it gives to all our students in Illinois. And so this is encouraging all of our public universities, and we'll become one of only two states in the nation to have all its public universities on the Common App, which just takes out so many expense barriers and logistical barriers, makes it simpler for students to afford themselves all the great options that exist in Illinois. And so we're happy that this is happening and finally getting everybody on the Common App.
So what's the benefit of the Common App to students and their families who might be footing the bill for the cost of their college applications?
Yeah, it removes some expense in the application process itself and takes a lot of time. As somebody who's got a college junior, I remember a few years back and all the various different applications. It's a big, and although my son did the bulk of the work, it's a big commitment of family time as well. And so it makes it easier for families to help explore all the options and make applications and submit applications in one place.
So what's the benefit to our public universities here? I know historically there's been a concern about out-migration, students from Illinois going to colleges and universities in other states. Is there a hope or a sense that switching to the Common App will encourage students to stay in Illinois as they pursue post-secondary education?
You are exactly right. We believe it will, that it makes it easier for them to choose an Illinois option, and there are hundreds of great Illinois options, both on the public and private sector side. And so we want to make sure that they're aware of them. They can easily avail themselves of those great opportunities and perhaps consider schools they may not have otherwise considered in Illinois, particularly our public universities, our 12 public universities that have amazing programs and curriculums of study for the careers of the 21st century. And so that's what we want all Illinoisans to have the opportunity to access. And we think it will help students explore those opportunities that are world-class learning opportunities right here in their own home state that are affordable and accessible.
This might seem like a silly question, but why is it important to the governor and his administration that we invest in things like providing the Common App to all our public universities? Why does that matter? Why is it important that we keep students in this state?
Well, to support our state institutions and also to support our students in obtaining the skills that we believe are going to be necessary for 21st century careers, and hopefully careers that will keep them here in Illinois, help investing in our Illinois economy. And so it's a win-win on all sides that they're keeping our Illinois institutions robust with robust enrollments, and also hopefully growing the number of Illinoisans who achieve a higher education degree or certificate or training, and making sure that more and more Illinoisans have access to it, because that's, we're in a knowledge economy. And we know that. And so we want to make sure all Illinoisans have opportunities to obtain a higher education. And this does make it easier.
That's reporter Lee Gaines speaking with Illinois Deputy Governor for Education, Jesse Ruiz, about transitioning all 12 of the state's public universities to the Common Application. Many Illinois colleges have seen enrollment drops this year due to the pandemic. That includes community colleges. And while officials try to reverse the trend, some students say the pandemic has helped them rethink their goals. From Chicago, Adriana Cardona-Magiga has more.
When Vincent Baez entered his second year at Harold Washington College, one of City Colleges of Chicago, last fall, he knew school wasn't the same under remote instruction.
Being away from other classmates, professors, and that kind of in-person experience that I think I thrive on, it really hurt me in a way.
Baez's grades began to suffer, and he wasn't as motivated as he was before the pandemic.
Going through the routine of going downtown, sitting in your class with other classmates, looking your teacher in the eye instead of through a screen, it's something you can't replicate.
Staring at a screen for long hours for PowerPoint presentations last spring and fall, he says,
it's, for lack of a better word, it's boring and it's draining. And it really sucks the life out of what's supposed to be important.
Baez is among thousands of students who decided to postpone college for at least a semester during the pandemic. Undergraduate enrollment was down at many Illinois colleges and universities last fall, continuing an existing trend. Community colleges appear to be among the most affected by the pandemic. Enrollment went down by 14% this fall and spring compared to last school year. This includes City Colleges of Chicago. But enrollment is steady at more competitive schools with lots of applicants. Despite that, some students, especially immigrant, low-income, and first-generation college students, are having a harder time at those schools during the pandemic. Jessica Vargas, a senior at the University of Chicago, says she's overwhelmed.
Some of us had easier times on campus because we had access to resources and supports. But now since the pandemic, it's just been a lot more difficulty trying to, like, navigate resources. The economic instability has been very stressful. And thinking about graduation has been really terrifying.
Vargas grew up on the southeast side. She was supposed to graduate in June. Instead, she put school on pause. At the start of the pandemic, she says professors were more accommodating, but that changed as time went on.
Try to figure out college during a pandemic, and then to also figure out the job market right now, it was just too much for me.
Vargas ended up in the emergency room and was hospitalized for a few days recently due to school-induced stress.
I wanted to get the college degree. I wanted to just get a job. My parents should have been out of poverty yesterday, but I was burnt out for a lot of it. Like, because of Zoom University, I missed campus. I missed being involved with my mentors who had, like, supported me.
Postponing school was never an option for Vargas before. Other students feared being judged for taking a break from school. Xiolet Nellum is one of them. She was also a City College of Chicago student when the pandemic hit.
I felt myself running without a goal, and that was just pointless to me. It was pointless to take classes and not know where I was going.
Aside from online classes, she's been watching her twin sisters while her mother works. Feeling overwhelmed, she realized she needed a break this spring. There is a lot of concern about students getting off track because of the pandemic, but experts say some students need that extra time. Dominique McCoy is with the To and Through Project, which seeks to increase high school and college completion for low-income students of color.
We talk about schools often to this realm of two-year and four-year colleges, but oftentimes students are taking 6 years to complete their degree, and that's actually normal.
Nelum, Baez, and Vargas all hope to return to school. But Vargas says if college officials want students to keep showing up to class and graduate, they need to invest more in resources to support them, especially during tough times. Adriana Cardona-Magigad, WBEZ News.
Some Democratic Illinois lawmakers have proposed repealing the abortion law known as the Parental Notification Act, which has been enforced since the middle of 2013. Maureen McKinney heard from some abortion rights supporters and those opposed about the law.
Stories about keeping or repealing Illinois' Parental Notification Act sound somewhat similar. Both sides say it protects rights, but whose? Teens or parents? While Illinois has extensive abortion rights on the books, parental notification is a holdover from more than two decades ago. Dr. Brooke Bellow couldn't tell a parent she was having abortions. The counselor and author is founder of the organization More to Life. She said she is a survivor of human trafficking and a preteen rape. Early in her teens, she was forced to have multiple abortions by her traffickers. Those procedures left her unable to bear children. Scarred, she had to have multiple operations, including a hysterectomy.
Had my parent been notified, my mother would have known what city I was in. She would have known what street I possibly would have been near. She could have contacted law enforcement.
Bellow spoke at a press conference for a coalition called Parents for the Protection of Girls. It was formed to block repeal of Illinois' PNA.
Why would you want a child to keep something secret that's going to affect the rest of her life?
Supporters of repealing laws say there are times when notifying a parent within the two-day window is just not possible. Bridget Leahy is with Planned Parenthood Illinois Action. The group is the political arm of Planned Parenthood of Illinois.
The only young people who this truly impacts are those who are in family situations where it is unsafe or dangerous or very ill-advised for them to involve that parent. But the rest are already doing so. You can't have a law that is going to make families be able to function well or talk well with each other.
Dr. Rebecca Comito, a Chicago obstetrician and gynecologist, argues that the PNA should be repealed. She talked about her experiences with teens seeking abortion.
When they do not involve a parent or guardian, young patients share with me that this is because they're concerned about judgment that may lead to social or financial isolation from their family, being forced out of their homes, or experiencing sexual or physical violence.
But the Reverend John Jones, a pastor at a Tinley Park church, said there are consequences of abortion for teens as well. He, like Bellow, was part of a virtual press conference last week.
It seems unfathomable that the law would allow a minor to make a decision to access abortion without any adult guidance. We know the potential severe physical and emotional consequences associated with abortion. We cannot leave our children to face them alone.
Bob Gilligan is executive director of the Catholic Conference of Illinois. He agrees with Jones and notes that the law does not require consent, only notification.
So parents and guardians have to consent to just about anything a child wants to do today. Field trips, medication in schools, joining sport. We have laws that protect parents and treat children differently because we know that teens are impulsive. They engage in risky behavior. And science tells us that their brains are not even fully formed until 25.
But Bridget Leahy of Planned Parenthood points out that other actions related to pregnancy do not require parental consent or notification. Those include prenatal testing and care and procedures including a cesarean section or giving up a child for adoption. Neither do testing and treatment for sexually transmitted infections and sexual assault and mental health and substance abuse counseling. Emily Worth is an ACLU attorney who works with teens who seek judicial bypass. In the 7 years the law has been enforced, more than 500 teens have sought the alternative to parental notification. They go before a judge to explain why they can't tell a parent they want to have an abortion. There are clients, she said, who were delayed so long by the bypass process that it was too late for them to have an abortion.
And it's these young people that we could not help and who may have ended up parenting before they were really ready. Those are the ones that haunt me.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
Well, just ahead on Statewide, we'll look back at Illinois' Constitution more than 50 years after it was ratified. I'm Sean Crawford. The Illinois Constitution turned 50 years old in December. Longtime journalist Charlie Wheeler covered the convention where it was written in 1970, and I talked with him about the document and its legacy. So, Charlie, let's go back 50 years. Why did people feel a new constitution was needed?
At the time, people referred to the existing constitution, which was drafted and ratified way back in 1870, as a constitution for the horse and buggy age. And so it was, why do we have to live under these constraints of a 19th century document? Some of the things were totally irrelevant anymore. There was language in there about the Columbian Exposition, the limit on the state's ability to borrow money, for example. There was a provision in the old constitution that said if the state wanted to borrow more than $250,000, it had to ask the voters in a referendum. By the time you reached the turn of the century, $250,000 wasn't very much, even back in the 1900s. Probably by the 1950s, it was pretty clear that this constitution just needed to be updated and rewritten from beginning to end. And so that's what the delegates who gathered in Springfield back right at the tail end of 69 and then worked through 70 up until September of 70, that's what they did.
So it was a massive undertaking to go back to something written 100 years earlier. Well, here we are 50 years on since this one was put in place. And while there have been quite a few changes to the Constitution since it was first put in place, we have not had that type of review that a constitutional convention would bring for the 1970 document.
No, and I think part of it was the people who drafted the document in 1970 were aware of the constraints that the old charter had placed on the state. And so they tried to set out kind of a broad general framework and then allow it to the General Assembly and future generations to fill in the details, I guess would be one way to look at it. If you were to read through the Constitution, you'll see many places where it says, as provided by law. And that meant that the delegates were saying, here's kind of the grand scheme, but it's up to the General Assembly to fill in the details. Because, as I say, they were very cognizant of the 1870 Constitution with some of its restrictions, some of the very specific provisions that might have made sense back in 1870, but were totally irrelevant, if you want to use the term, by the time 1970 came along.
Charlie, in your article, you use the term, the document made government more efficient, and what did you mean by that?
I think it clarified the roles, if you will, of the three branches of government. Under the old Constitution, for example, the lieutenant governor was the presiding officer over the Senate, just as we have at the federal level, where the vice president is the presiding officer over the U.S. Senate. Well, the delegates wanted to make sure the executive and the legislative were separated, so they did away with the lieutenant governor's role in the Senate. And instead, the Senate now elects its own president. They also clarified the budgeting. They made it clear that the governor proposes the budget, and then the legislature reacts, adjusts, amends, approves a budget, and the governor has the ability to reduce items, to strike items out with a veto. The legislature has the final word in that they can restore anything that he cut or reduced. It made it clear that we could have annual sessions. For most of the time that the 1870 Constitution was in effect, the General Assembly would meet in January of the odd-numbered year following the election in the preceding even-numbered year. They'd work for 6 months, they'd adjourn in June of the odd-numbered year, and they'd be gone. That would be it. They would not be back. A governor could bring them back in special session. But for example, if a governor were to veto a bill that was passed back in the olden days, there was no way for the legislature to override it because a governor was not going to call the legislature back into special session to override his veto. If I recall correctly, that 100-year span, I think there were only like three or four vetoes that were overridden, and those were on bills that were passed early enough in the spring that the governor had to act on them before the legislature went home on June 30th. If you will, those kinds of things, cleaning up some of the past practices. And for example, the revenue article is a lot broader. It gives a lot of authority to the General Assembly to increase and impose taxes. The one thing, as we learned, if you have an income tax, it has to be at a flat rate. Well, the old article in the old Constitution, for example, said that the General Assembly could tax certain occupations, and then it listed specifically peddlers, hawkers, showmen, jugglers, and innkeepers. So there was no clear authority to impose an income tax. As a matter of fact, at the beginning of the Depression, Republican Governor Lewis Emerson and the legislature passed a graduated income tax, but before it could actually take effect, the Supreme Court threw it out, saying, no, the Constitution doesn't say you can do that. And so those kinds of hangovers from way back when.
One key decision that was made was to only allow for a flat income tax. This topic has come up this year because Governor J.B. Pritzker had pushed for a graduated income tax system, but voters said no. Why was it written that way?
I think one of the overriding concerns of the delegates was whatever we do, we want it to be something that voters will be happy to ratify. And I think they were very much aware of the fact that there had been a prior convention in the 1920s whose product was rejected by the voters. And so there was always this concern.
When they were discussing these issues, which ones came up the most and which ones had the most debate?
Well, probably the most contentious ones were the four issues that the delegates decided that they would submit to the voters separately. So when voters went to the polls back in December of 1970, they had the question, should we adopt the Constitution or not? And if we adopt the Constitution, what should it say about these four issues? And the first one was cumulative voting. Should we retain the system that we've had for 100 years, where in each legislative district, three members are elected to the Illinois House, and a voter has three votes, which they can give all to one candidate, divide between two, or spread amongst three? And that was something that was enacted in 1870, and it was probably the most forward-reaching element of the 1870 Constitution, at least I would say, because it was seen as a way to bind the wounds of the state after the Civil War, where Southern Illinois was strongly Democrat and very much had a kind of, well, I shouldn't say very much, there were folks down there who really supported the Confederacy. Up north was solidly Republican. And so the delegates in 1870 figured, well, if we design this election system for the House, it will pretty much guarantee that Republicans would be elected from the South and Democrats from the North. So that's what we'll do. And that's how it played out for 100 years. So one of the questions was, well, should we keep this or should we go to single member districts? The second one is, should we continue to elect judges or should they be appointed by someone? Should we have capital punishment in Illinois or no? And then the fourth one was, should we reduce the age requirement for voting from 21 down to 18? Now, as you look back on it, you say to yourself, what's the big issue with whether you can vote at 18 or 21? I thought that was decided. Well, the voters 50 years ago said no, should be 21. But a couple years later, the U.S. Constitution was changed to reduce the age to 18. And then, of course, we followed suit. The voters kept cumulative voting until 1980, when the First Amendment to the new Constitution, the so-called Cutback Amendment, did away with cumulative voting and reduced the size of the House by one third. On the question of merit selection, voters said, no, we shouldn't have merit selection. And we still elect judges. And finally, they said, yes, let's keep capital punishment And then maybe, what would it be, 45 years later, maybe we finally outlawed capital punishment in Illinois. But it was funny because one of the issues that really didn't cause much of a concern was the Equal Rights Amendment that's in our Constitution. And it says the equal protection of the law shall not be denied or abridged on account of sex by the state or its units of local government and school districts. That was pretty straightforward. It didn't cause any great stir. And yet a few years later, the hottest issue in the General Assembly for the 70s, early 80s, was the federal Equal Rights Amendment, which said basically the same thing. Illinois never did get around to ratifying the federal ERA until just a couple of years ago. And another one that's probably gets more attention nowadays than anything else is the pension protection provision, which says that membership in any pension or retirement system of the state, any unit of local government or school district, or any agency or instrumentality thereof shall be an enforceable contractual relationship, the benefits of which shall not be diminished or impaired. Now, I don't remember at the time that that was one of the real hot button issues. And as a matter of fact, it was sort of seen as a corollary to one of the big asks that Mayor Daley had, which was home rule, the ability for local governments above a certain size to manage their own affairs without having to go to the state legislature every time they had to do something. Well, police and fire unions were very much concerned that if we give home rule to Mayor Daley and other municipalities, the first time there's any kind of a budget crunch, the first thing that the mayors will do is say, okay, we're going to cut pension benefits. And so to protect those benefits, the language was put into the Constitution. And at the time, there were people who said, well, if you write that into the Constitution, the General Assembly will never be able to change pension benefits going forward. And the people who were proposing the amendment, the reaction was, well, yeah, that's basically the idea here.
So all these years have passed and the many changes that have been proposed and some of them enacted to change the Constitution, the residents of the state have had a chance a couple of times to decide if they want another constitutional convention. They've turned down that idea twice, but some say they'd like to see it, reopening issues for discussion that others have pushed against. You mentioned the public employee unions as a good example of an issue when it comes to pension protections. Do you think we'll see another constitutional convention anytime soon? The next opportunity, I guess, to consider that and to possibly vote on it, I guess, would be 2028.
Yeah, that is correct. That was one of the things that was added to the new Constitution. Well, the then new Constitution 50 years ago, because one of the difficulties with the 1870 Constitution was it was very hard to change it, and there was no real process for asking voters, should we have another convention? But the delegates in 1970 were very aware of the fact that we don't want to lock the future into what we do today, because who knows what tomorrow is going to bring. So we should make sure there are provisions in here that make it easier to amend. They also put in the automatic call so that you don't have to wait. What would it have been? It would have been 98 years before, in 1968, the legislature asked Illinois voters, should we have another convention? And so every 20 years, as you say, the voters get asked. And the first one was in, it would have been in 1988, and 3/4 of the voters said no. Then in 2008, 2/3 of the voters said no, we don't need another convention. And the next one would be in 2028. Based on that trend, I don't think people are going to accept it. The thing is, I don't think there's anything in the Constitution that is so archaic or so unworkable that would require a convention as opposed to an amendment to deal with that particular problem. I don't think we need to totally restructure state government, which was one of the arguments made back then. We can do it, as I note in the article, we can do it with a scalpel through amendments rather than calling a convention and possibly putting a chainsaw to the whole thing.
That's journalist Charlie Wheeler, who covered the 1970 Illinois Constitutional Convention. That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and we'll return next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find all of our episodes there at statewideshow.com. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.